All right. I'm going to do a little bit, probably exactly the same as I did last Wednesday night, and kind of come up with my own questions and not go through the audience one by one. So that means you got to have some good comments like you did last Wednesday night. Last week we talked about the Israelites left Rephidim and they finally reached Sinai. They complained about a lack of water, and we talked all about that. And as we've talked about each class period, we're kind of trying to put ourselves in their situation and understand where they came from and what they've seen and that sort of thing. God provides for them time and again. They fought the Amalekites. They prevailed with God's help. But this week, the people not only will be reminded of God's care for them, but God will seek to make a covenant with the people. But when you read it and you read these two chapters, there's some preparation that needs to take place before that happens. That's a picture that we've had up there before, and nobody is certain that that's Mount Sinai, but that is the mountain that is generally regarded as Mount Sinai. So I guess when you think about the discussion that we'll have tonight, you think about God appearing to those Israelites, think about that. It just helps me. I don't know. I'm such a visual learner, though. All right, so question number one, how long, and I've got approximately in there because we don't know exactly, how long after leaving Egypt did they reach Mount Sinai? Remember how long that was?
40 to 45 days.
Yeah, 40 to 45 days. Chapter 12 and verse 6 and then in verse 51 says they left Egypt on the 14th day of the first month. They arrive in the third month, so about 40 to 45 days. So that's what I want us to think about. 40 to 45 days ago, they were, what was their situation? They were slaves. They were steeped in all of those Egyptian gods. They've been learning about who God is for these 40 to 45 days. Think about the miraculous things that they've seen already. Verse 2 says, they camped before the mountain while Moses went up to God. And we're not told why he initially goes up, I don't believe. But again, what had God told him about this mountain? Right. And so it has to be considered. He knew that this was the mountain, and he knew why they were there. So God calls to Moses out of the mountain there in verse 3, tells him to speak to the people. Something he's done since he was called. He's going to remind them of his care for them and describe what he intends for the people. So question two is, how does God describe the care that he has given the people? How does God describe that? Yeah, and similar there, Deuteronomy, the 32nd chapter, verse 9. But the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted heritage. He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness he encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, burying them on its pinions. So that's a little more descriptive right there. Isn't that a pretty good description of what God's done for his people so far? You think about all that he's done. You know, he promised way back what was going to happen. He didn't forget that promise. He fulfilled that promise. But even though they've been complaining, he just continues to provide for them. All right. What did God want the Israelites to keep? Well, before that, though, overall, what did he want them to keep? Verse 5. Yeah. What is a covenant? Yeah, and we see them in the form of treaties today, don't we? Maybe treaties between two countries. It's really a formal agreement between two parties. Chad, you and I could make a covenant, couldn't we? You know, over certain things. Abraham and Abimelech made a covenant in Genesis 21st chapter. So regular men can just make contracts and covenants with one another. This is a special covenant, isn't it? It's from a superior to an inferior, right? We're not God's equal, so it's not the exact same kind of covenant that we could see or a treaty we might see today. So God makes certain promises, and then He demands certain acts of obedience. Question four, what did God promise to make of Israel? Yeah, verses 5 and 6, I believe. You shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So, those titles now are applied to who? Applied to Christians as well there in 1 Peter 2:9. I believe that was in the book. But if you look at how precious God's people are to Him, you know, all the people of the earth at this time belong to Him, right? He created everyone, but these special people belong to Him. He chose Israel to be His special people. So He brings them out of slavery and tells them He will make them a holy nation. Do you think they had any idea what all that entailed at this point?
I don't believe so. So the same promise that was made to Abraham. So that essentially the whole story of Exodus is this.
But in this particular part, as we get to this particular part of Exodus, I guess let's summarize, or for me it's easier to think about all of this as a whole, because they're going to stay at Sinai for a good bit of time from here on out into the book of Numbers before they leave. But for me, it's easier if I can kind of summarize what happens over the next couple of months when you look at everything that kind of starts today. So God offers to make a covenant with them. They say they want the covenant, and they promise to keep the commandments. Again, not sure that they understood exactly what this entailed. God gives them the basic rules of the covenant. Then God gives Moses some specific commandments for the people and then a list of other rules. And so the people, again, say, yes, we want the covenant. We're going to obey those rules. And so God gives Moses more instruction there through chapter 23. But less than 6 weeks later, the people make a golden calf and break this covenant with God, the one that we're talking about tonight. God's ready to destroy the people, but Moses intercedes. God says He'll give them the land as a possession, but that He will no longer be in their midst. Moses again intercedes and asks God to pardon the people, and then God renews His covenant with the people. So, this is the first time, this is not the first time that they've seen those special things God has done for them, but they begin to see God and experience God in a different way tonight, don't they? Much different way. As we said a minute ago, they thought that they were ready to obey, and as it turns out, I don't believe that they understood. They have a lot to learn here. So the covenant that they said that they would accept required real obedience. What is the definition of real obedience? Yeah. I guess I was asking you to read my mind, but I think that's right. From the heart, you understand the why of what you were doing, right? Verse 5, remember what we read there. He says, if you will indeed, and I have in parentheses truly, if you will truly obey my voice. So in order to be His special people in this holy nation that He said He would make of them, they needed to act in a certain way. And He's going to instruct them exactly how to act. They would be unique and set apart. And is it the same with us today?
Exactly. So that's what it means about, you know, when we talk about being holy, set apart.
All right, so question five is, how did the people respond to the offer of this covenant?
Yeah. Yeah, at verse 7, so Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And I imagine it's not all the people, but it was probably those heads of the tribes and that sort of thing, the elders that were there that answered that. But notice that Moses then tells the Lord all that the people have said. Do you think Moses was pleased to hear this when they said, all that you say, we will do? Now, Moses being a man, has it been very long ago that Moses complained a little bit about the people? What did Moses say? You remember? Yeah, that's exactly right. They said, look, they're so mad at this point, they're about to stone me. And then now what you have is, I think he's a little encouraged that they say, everything that you say, we will do. But I'm wondering if in the back of his mind he's thinking, well, I sure hope they do. Because I know that I would be doing that. All right, so question six, how would God appear to Moses and why? Yeah, and let's remember this verse right here where he says that the people may hear when I speak. So what was God's purpose in speaking this way? He told us why. Yeah, so to further confirm Moses as his spokesman, right? Look, when I tell Moses something, this is exactly what I intend for you to do. When Moses tells you something, it's come straight from me. So, but even at this point, the people weren't ready for God to come to them, right? They had to do some preparation at this point. What preparations were to be made for the Lord appearing to them? Yeah, there were a few things that they had to do, right? The Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today. Now, what's consecrate mean? Yeah, sanctify. Yeah, set apart, sanctify. They need to be made special. They can't appear in front of the Lord just the way that they are right now. Consecrate them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. So the third day is when this is going to happen. And then he also adds in verse 15, be ready for the third day, do not go near a woman. I think the idea there is, should they be of a single mind? In other words, if you deny yourself a pleasure, that shows that you're focused, right? And I believe that has something to do with that. You know, not that that is especially unclean, but I think he's saying, look, this is an important thing that's about to happen. You need to consecrate yourself. You need to wash your garments. You need to be focused on what's about to happen. Could the people go up onto Mount Sinai? Yeah, this is... Huh? Yet not yet. They could go, but it might be detrimental to their health, right? Yeah, verse 12, and you shall set limits for the people all around, saying, take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. All right, so put yourself in Moses' place here. How many people are we talking about? A lot? A couple of million people? If you're Moses, this sounds like a tall order, I would imagine. You know, that you've got to make sure that nobody comes near the mountain to touch the mountain. And so we're not told exactly what was done to make sure that that didn't happen. But I just thought when I read that, that's a tall order. Chad?
I think it puts responsibility on the people themselves. Not if you touch the
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Verse 13 says, no hand shall touch him. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot, whether man or beast, he shall not live. And so set limits to me sounds like he told them exactly where they could and could not go. Because the mountain is irregular, but I mean, he says, don't go to the edge of the mountain. And not to go through that part of Lamar's class again, but you look over here and you compare and contrast, and really that's what he's doing as we studied in the Hebrews class. The New Covenant is so much better, and you talk about it being approachable. Look over in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, verse 18. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given. Even if a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses says, I tremble with fear. Now, that's something that we didn't have in our study tonight, right? So, I mean, Moses, that made an impression on Moses as well. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. So, you know, he really puts that out there and compares that to what we have today. And isn't that so much better?
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of the descriptive language here. But verse 14 tells us when they would know to come near the mountain, and what was that? Trumpet blast? Yeah, I just
wonder, you have 2 million people here. They had to be gathered up there, because when he goes to gather them up, they've got to be close to what's going on here. But just the sound of that trumpet, if they were as afraid of all of this, I think that was part of their fear. So Moses does just as God commands him to. The people's garments were washed and they were consecrated. So on the morning of the third day, there were thunderings and lightnings and then a thick cloud on the mountain. You know, think again about that picture we started with. And then the sound of the trumpet blast. Verse 16 says that all the people in the camp trembled. So if you can imagine, all of this takes place in the morning of the third day. So they, if you're an Israelite, you've spent 2 days getting ready. Would washing their garments have been an easy thing to do? What had they just been complaining they didn't have? Right. This wouldn't have been a very easy thing to do. So they're washing their garments, they're consecrating themselves. You know, this is something on the third day they knew was going to happen. So all this anticipation builds, and then you have the thundering and the lightning, and all of it is centered around Mount Sinai. You know, and you've got this thick cloud right there. And so verse 17 says that Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain, is the way the English Standard Version has that. They took their stand at the foot of the mountain. So this is the mountain they couldn't touch, but they take their stand at the foot of the mountain. They know where this is going to take place, and so Moses has them in the right spot. So question 9 is, describe God's appearance on the mountain. They're around verse 18. Yeah, very descriptive, right, Mike? Now, Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. So all this happens. Moses is going up into that. Adel? Yeah, this is. Yeah, this thick cloud, in addition to the thundering and the lightning. James, did you have something? Well, he's going to go up the mountain and then back down the mountain and then go back up the mountain.
I don't know how far it goes, but anyway.
Right. Right. Yeah, Luke, yeah. You already said that they know they can't go there. Verse 21 is what you're talking about. God tells Moses to warn the people again. He says, don't let them break through to look at the Lord, and many of them perish. But verse 22, God tells Moses to let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, and he says, lest the Lord break out against them. Who were these priests? Do we know? Well, it's like we've said before. There are things that we don't know. He's gonna deliver that. We're gonna be talking about that in the next several weeks. But there are things that we don't know. Right. Right. Yeah, we just don't know exactly who they are and what function that they had right here. I mean, we would understand that they would be making a sacrifice or something like that.
45 days out, right?
Wouldn't think so, but I don't know.
Well, you tell them they're running God, and they are.
Mm-hmm. Probably was, and it's like we've been reading about, I believe. Yeah, he's going to tell them in the next several weeks. We're going to study about when he tells them this is what you've got to do, and how to set all of that up and so forth. But yeah, right now all we know is this is probably those that we have read about in the past. Right. Yep. And then as we go through, compare that to the new covenant that we have today. You're exactly right. Anything else? All right, so Moses responds by saying that according to what had already been commanded, they had set limits so the people could not come up into the mountain. So, James, you're right. He said, yep, we've already done that. We've taken care of that. God tells Moses to go down and bring Aaron back with him, and again gives the warning to not let the priests break through. So this is the part that I'll ask you this question. So God tells Moses, go down and bring Aaron back up with him, but again gives the warning to not let the priests break through. Moses then goes back down to the people And he tells the people these things. And so as we get into chapter 20, I guess I'll ask the question, who did he give these? As we start chapter 20, God begins giving these commandments. Who is he giving these commandments to? Is he giving them straight to Moses, or is he giving them to the people? Or is he giving them to the people and Moses at the same time? Yeah, God is. But who is God giving these commandments to? Well, I'm not sure about that. That's why I'm asking the question. You look over at Deuteronomy, the fifth chapter. And if I don't think I've got that on the slide here. But Deuteronomy, the fifth chapter, 1 through 5, Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain." I guess my thought there is I had always made the assumption that he gave those directly to Moses, and the people, you know, just stood there, and then they didn't know anything about these commandments until Moses delivered those things to them. And I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, but it certainly would seem that God requesting that they consecrate themselves and doing all that they needed to do, I think what he's doing when he gives these commandments to the people is, he says, you know, if you can envision this, he brings the people out of Egypt. He's done all of these miracles in his care for them. They're constantly learning who God is. Now he's ready to deliver his covenant to the people. And you have all of this great and terrible sight that just must have been very spectacular. And he needs to deliver this to them in such a way that it makes an impression upon them that they understand exactly that they need to be, that they need to act a certain way. And by giving them these commands, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but these first commands that he gives, are they not indicative that they would be acting, if they did these commands, they'd be acting like a special people? They would certainly be peculiar at this point. So, I'm not sure.
Well, I think Deuteronomy 5 certainly seals, you know, what you're saying as far as them speaking, as it were, face to face with them. If he's not speaking directly to them, then the request that they make later on doesn't make a lot of sense.
That's kind of my thought, and that's what I have in my notes, is that they didn't want him to talk to them after that. They said, "Look, you be our mediator at this point." And that just made an impression on me as I studied this, because I had always thought it was the other way, but I can just imagine standing there with all that I had done to prepare and all that I'm seeing at this point, and then out of the cloud, here comes the voice of God, and he says, you know, all of these commands. So, before he gives these instructions, though, he gave him a reminder of who he was and what he did there in verse 2. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." Because of all of that, starting there in verse 3, "You shall have no other gods before me," and then follows in verses 3 through 6 to discuss this. "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So I go back again to say, if you're at the foot of the mountain and you're seeing all of this, and then God says, remember, here's who I am, this is what I've done, because I've done all these things, you're not going to have any other gods before me. You're not going to make any carved images and so forth. But he says there in verse 5, I am a jealous God. How so? In what way is God a jealous God? Yeah, I need a reference to Isaiah 42:8. Can somebody read Isaiah 42:8? Because I wrote that in and I didn't put it up here. Not that that even could be done, but you know they were told, this is because I am who I am, you're not going to have any other gods there. Well, and I think the way that I would put that is, if you came from a land with all of these other gods that had, that were represented by objects, and now you see this God, the tendency may be to say, yes, but I really need something that I can look at and handle and come close to and all of that. And he's saying, no, you're not even going to do that. So we've talked about 1 through 6 and talked about, you know, I'm a jealous God, you're not going to have any other gods before me, but really verse 7 is really kind of related to the same thought, right? And I think this is the whole dialogue he's beginning to have with them. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. So what does this mean? Before you answer, what would this have meant to those Israelites at the foot of the mountain who have been 45 days out of Egypt at this point if they were told, don't take the name of the Lord in vain? What would that have meant to them? Yeah, it much different than in Egypt, because maybe these other little g gods, they were talked about all of the time, and they would see things that would happen, and they would ascribe those things to those gods, right? This is a much different situation. So it makes you think about, you know, today, is there seemingly, with a lot of people, no fear of God at all? You look around and you see things and you think, do they just have no fear at all? You know, the things that they talk about and the way that they take God's name in vain, it's just, you look at it and you compare it to what they would have seen there on Mount Sinai and that they were terrified of.
Well, not just his name, but spiritual concepts of him on God.
Right. Right.
So there's all kinds of spiritual concepts we take away.
That's a good point. 8 through 11, he tells them to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. What had they heard about a Sabbath already? Yeah, and that's all they knew about it at this point. It was, hey, you're not going to collect any manna. You're going to collect double this day because you're not going to go out and do it here. So they that's all they knew about it, but he's given them a little bit more detail. So then in 12 through 17, he begins to tell them more about how they're going to be a peculiar people. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. So again, you're standing there, and this is what God is telling you out of the thick cloud. You're not going to do this and you're not going to do that. And so that maybe these are some things that were just commonplace where they came from, and now they're hearing from him, these are things that you'll not be doing. Question number 10 is, what was the reaction of the people? Yeah. They were afraid and trembled. They stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die." Over in Deuteronomy, the fifth chapter, over 23, a little bit more detail there. As soon as you heard the voice out of the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, "Behold, the Lord our God has shown us His glory and greatness, and we have heard His voice out of the midst of the fire." And that's why I was talking about, you know, when I read that, I thought, you know, maybe I need to change my thinking on that song. This day we have seen God speak with man, and man still live. Now, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, we shall die. For who is there of all flesh that has heard the voice of the living God speaking out of the midst of the fire as we have and has still lived? Go near and hear all that the Lord our God will say, and speak to us all that the Lord our God will speak to you, and we will hear and do it. And the Lord heard your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, "I have heard the words of this people, which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they've spoken. Oh, that they had such a heart as this always, to fear me and to keep all my commandments, that it might go well with them and with their descendants forever." So, nothing like being able to read another passage and get a little bit more detail.
And what a terrifying experience.
Yeah. Yeah, we can read that, but we just have no idea. You know, you look at some of the special effects in movies. I'm not sure even special effects in a movie could do that.
Look, you know, we keep emphasizing how these people reacted as well as we should. But the Lord has in mind future generations. Hopefully this is going to be told to the future generations. And even the prophets will all along bring up what happened at Mount Sinai. So, you know,
you're exactly right. All right, so question 11. For what purpose had God come to the people on Mount Sinai? Moses tells them why in verse 20. He's making an impression on them specifically for that purpose. The fear of God should be before them, and the purpose of that fear was that they may not sin. So verse 21 indicates that the people stood back, and then Moses goes back toward God where he receives the laws that, starting in verse 22. So the Lord says to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourself gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice it on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it." So again, they've come to from a land where they had all of these objects, and they could probably look, you know, across the landscape and see all of these objects that represented gods. And God's telling Moses again, that's not going to be the case with me. We don't know the mind of God, but it does cause you to speculate a little bit when he says, only make it of earth or unhewn stone. And we might can suppose why that is. Why do you think that might have been? Yeah. Yeah, because the way we would do it would be to say, oh, do we need to build an altar? Well, let me put my creativity in it. And then all of a sudden, what I built, that kind of glorifies me because it's nice and pretty, or it's very ornate, and all of a sudden people are saying, hey, we need to get him to build the altar because he really builds good altars. You know, and all of a sudden it's about the person and not God. That's a good point. He's going to give some instructions about building the altar there in the 27th chapter, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. But that one will be used in the tabernacle. So, finally, in verse 26, God adds that there should be no steps. And why does it say there should be no steps? What was he concerned about, apparently? Yeah, I mean, that just shows, and we've used this before when we've talked about modesty, but I mean, God was concerned about that, right? There are things that should not be seen. All right, anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah, that's true. Probably he feels the same today about that he felt back then. That's right.